Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is KIX Web Services Part 2 Deployment. Today's presenter is Nigel William. Nigel is a certified IT specialist working at the IBM Design Center in Montpellier, France. He specializes in core business transformation, connectors, and service-oriented architectures. He is the author of several papers and IBM Red books, and he speaks frequently on KIX and WebSphere topics. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Nigel.
Thank you, Joseph, and good morning or good afternoon to everybody on the call. Let me start by adding to the introduction that Joseph gave for me. I used to work in the Hersey lab and some years ago moved to the Design Center in Montpellier. For those of you not familiar with the geography of France, it's on the Mediterranean coast in the south of France. What we do in the Design Center is that we help customers to implement different infrastructure solutions. Most of our customers are traditional mainframe customers. We have a focus on this System Z. And my role within that team is really to help customers to integrate KIX applications into their new solutions, most of which are based around service-oriented architecture. So this webcast is specifically about KIX Web Services. It's entitled Part 2 because last week, Paul Cooper, who's on the call, did a webcast on best practice around developing web services. And so I'm going to focus today on deploying web services, infrastructure considerations, rather than development considerations, which were covered by Paul last week. So Joseph, could you move to chart 2, please? So I'm going to start with a high-level overview of the web services infrastructure. It will be brief because I think most of you will be familiar with this, because either you've implemented web services or you're testing web services, or maybe you just followed the webcast of last week. Then I'm going to look at the general deployment considerations, which are common across our projects. There are many, but I've picked out 3 for this webcast. Firstly, how we can secure web services, how we can make them available, and how we can enable them to meet the performance expectations, which of course vary from project to project. The bulk of the presentation is going to be based on a Design Center project, a customer case study, a customer with whom we've been working for some years, and a customer that we've helped to implement a web services infrastructure, not just with KIX, but across a family of products, including the WebSphere family and products such as WebSphere Data Power. So following the customer study, we're going to look at what's different between the different KIX versions. Most of what I say during this webcast applies to any version of KIX from KIX DS 3.1. And where this is not the case, I'll try to point it out. At the end of the presentation, we have a couple of charts which focus on the differences between version 3.1, version 3.2, and the most recent version, KIX DS version 4. And at the end, of course, there'll be time for question and answer. Could you go to chart 3, please, Joseph? So this chart is really just a list of resources. Of course, it's the normal list of information centers. It's recommended that you use the information centers on the web because these contain the latest information. And then there are a series of red books around different topics, including architecture, implementation, performance, security, many of the things that we're going to talk about in this webcast. Some of these red books have been written here in Montpellier, and of course, I therefore recommend them to you. If you could go to chart 4, please, Joseph. So here we see the typical scenarios, the ways in which our customers are using Kik's web services. At the top of the chart, we see the service provider scenario. This is the place where most customers start, and it's enabling a Kik's application. We see here the application, the integration logic, the business logic, the data access logic. It's enabling a Kik's application as a web service to be called from the web service requester, which may be anywhere. But typically, in my experience, it's a web service requester, probably written in Java, but not always, running in one of the family of WebSphere products. We see WebSphere application server, WebSphere process server, WebSphere message broker. I'm going to talk about data power, WebSphere data power. It may be .NET, which is also a common scenario. At the bottom of the chart, we see Kik's as a service requester itself. And recently, we see now more and more of these types of scenarios being implemented by our customers. This is where an existing Kik's application or a new Kik's application needs to make a web service call to somewhere else. And again, it can be anywhere that supports web services. So the same list typically shown on the chart. What's driving this use of Kik's web services, I think it's a number of things. There seems to be a growing need to integrate internal systems, so we see web services being used to integrate internal systems running on different platforms or perhaps simply running on the System Z platform. We see an increasing need to interoperate with business partners to perform new business, to grow business. And the third factor really is compliance with standards and regulations. As an example, we have in Europe financial regulations. One of these is the Single European Payments Area, which we refer to as SEPA. And this is a standard set of rules and XML message formats that dictate how European banks have to interoperate in order to process payments in euros, so payments such as credit transfers and direct debits. As I said, these are a set of rules and message formats, and those message formats are defined as XML schema. So our European banks are implementing solutions for SEPA, which normally requires new software, and those payments systems normally have to integrate with the existing core banking applications to find out information about customer accounts and so on. As those core banking applications are typically implemented in Kik's, we see this standard driving more and more use of Kik's web services. So many of the projects I'm working on are helping customers to implement solutions that respond to these regulations. So if we could go to chart 5, please, Joseph. So chart 5 shows an overview of the web services framework. I'm going to be brief on this chart because Paul introduced many of these things last week, and I think most of this will be familiar to you already. One thing I'd like to say is that this framework has not really changed significantly since it was first introduced in Kik's TS 3.1, which is a good thing because it means that there's a consistency about the way that web services are implemented and deployed across between our versions of the product. Basically, what we see in this chart is a business logic program, which is the box B in Kik's, being accessed through a web service call, in this case a SOAP message. And basically what we see here is that there needs to be some adaption or transformation of the incoming SOAP message into a format that the business logic program understands. And typically that format is a COM area or CCA, Channel Container Interface. So Qix provides a runtime to do this transformation. It provides the transport mechanisms, which are HTTP or WebSphere MQ, and it provides this capability called the pipeline, which is a series of message handlers that allow you to operate on that message prior to it being mapped into a comm area or container. So those message handlers in the pipeline, you can provide yourself. And Qix also provides standard message handlers for standard functions, such as the SOAP message handler, which is responsible for parsing and processing the SOAP envelope. We show SOAP here not because SOAP is a requirement for a Qix web service. You can develop web services that are not based on the SOAP standard, but it is the most common standard, and some of the facilities within Qix rely on the fact that, or to use those facilities, you need to use SOAP. But it's not a requirement in order to use web services in general. What we see at the bottom of the picture after the pipeline is the data mapping, and this is something that was discussed in detail last week. The data mapping is the mapping of the body of the SOAP message, which is XML format, to the comm area. This can be done in a number of ways. It can be done by Qix. It can be done by your own programs. And these mappings can be generated either through the Qix supplied utilities or the rational developer for systems there. This chart shows Qix as a service provider. Like we said previously, Qix can also be a service requester. And in order for Qix to be a service requester, Qix provides an API. That API is the Invoke Web Service API. If we can go to the next chart, please, Joseph, chart 6. So now we get on to the main part of this presentation, which is about deployment and the main issues that Qix customers have when deploying web services, the main challenges that they have. And one of those challenges is security. How do you secure your web services? It's true that SOA, web services, Qix web services, provide additional business flexibility. They make a Qix application available to any web service client, which is a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. From the point of view of security, it's an additional risk. So how do we manage that risk? And the main questions that you have to address are on this chart. Basically, the chart shows a web service requester running in WebSphere application server, and that service requester is making a service request to Qix. What we see is that the service requester is itself part of an application which is being used by a user. She's called Alice. So Alice logs onto WebSphere. She probably authenticates. And the J2EE or JEE application makes a web service call to Qix. The first question we have to consider is, how do we authenticate the requester to Qix? Because we don't want anybody making that request. So we need to consider questions of authentication. We need to consider who we're authenticating. Are we authenticating Alice in this chart? Are we authenticating the application server itself? So there are different types of authentication that we can implement. What we see in this chart is a typical type of scenario whereby we often don't need to authenticate again, but we simply need to enable the identity of the end user, Alice, to be propagated in some way to kicks. And so we have a concept, which is a common thing that we see, of identity assertion, where a user's identity is propagated or asserted from one runtime to another runtime. And we'll see this being implemented in the customer example that I get to later. Another question is, how do we propagate or send security credentials? We can send those credentials either in the transport layer, or we can send them in the web service request, the SOAP message itself. An example of a transport credential is an HTTP basic authentication or an SSL client authentication. But that type of authentication tends to be good only for point-to-point type of solutions. When a web service request has to go through multiple subsystems, generally it's better to have the security credentials within the message itself. And to do that, we have various standards, which are the Web Services Security Standard and the family of standards, including Web Services Trust. And KIC supports these standards. Again, we'll see how these are implemented in our project example. The last question there is about confidentiality and data integrity. Do we need to secure and ensure the privacy of the data as it passes from the service requester to the service provider? The same criteria applies. We can use SSL to encrypt. We can also use Web Services Security XML encryption to encrypt. So we have this question always of transport-based security or message-based security. So these are the questions. What's the best practice? We can go to the next chart, Joseph, which is chart 7. What I recommend you to do for best practice, because this is a complex subject, is to read the Red Book, Securing KIX Web Services. What this chart tries to do is to summarize some of that best practice in one chart, which is a challenge. But what I've done here is list some of the things that we see as reoccurring themes and best practice across our projects. The first one is that if you need to secure a service and you're just dealing with point-to-point, service requester A calls service requester B, service provider B rather, then you can use transport-based security, SSL, HTTP basic authentication, and KIX can use these to secure web services. There's some value in doing this because these types of security mechanisms are optimized. SSL has been around for a long time. Time is optimized. It can be offloaded to hardware crypto devices. It can be optimized in other ways. However, in more complex environments with more advanced requirements, particularly when there are intermediaries involved, different subsystems between the service requester and the service provider, generally what we find is that putting the credentials of the service requester into the SOAP message itself is more useful. So we have this standard called the Web Services Security Standard, which allows for message-level authentication, data integrity, and encryption. KIX can process as headers in a SOAP message security tokens, including the username token, which is a simple username and password, or a username only. And it can also process X509 certificates, which are incorporated as part of the SOAP header. Sometimes, and this is particularly the case when you are using web services to interoperate with business partners, Sometimes those business partners demand the use of other security tokens. So we have Kerberos tokens, SAMOR tokens, LTPA tokens, all of which can be used as security credentials. Kix doesn't support these natively. It doesn't know how to process a Kerberos token. It doesn't know how to extract a user ID from an LTPA token. But what it can do is that it can interoperate with another system that does know how to do these things. And to do that, it uses the WS Trust specification. Such a system that knows how to map security tokens is the Tivoli Federated Identity Manager, or TFIM. The WS Trust support in Kix was introduced in Kix TS version 3.2. The third point on this chart, another common thing that we see as being a requirement is to apply some security before the request gets to Kix or before the request gets to the mainframe. And again, this is particular to projects that are based around interoperability with business partners. And so within IBM, we have the WebSphere Data Power product, which is an SOA appliance, and it's quite typical to see this appliance being used as, if you like, a security gateway to the mainframe. It can authenticate service requesters, it can validate XML, it can protect against attacks which are specific to web services, such as XML denial of service attacks. And it can do these things without imposing a large CPU cost on the mainframe. And again, in the project example, we'll show how we use data power within our project. But Joseph, if you could go to the next chart, please, chart 8. So we'll come back to security with the project example, but let's go on to the next key requirement that we see across these customer projects. And that is, how do we ensure that the service is always available? Now, you may have other availability requirements. They vary across projects. But for the highest requirements, 24/7, it's not good enough to deploy a service in Kix on a single Kix region. We have to take advantage of the KixFlex. We have to be able to workload manage across multiple Kix regions. We have to be able to deploy web services across multiple Kix regions. What this chart shows is a set of what we call here web service owning regions and a set of application owning regions. And these work together in order to process a web services workload. So the questions are, how do we workload manage the service requests across the web service owning regions? How do we set a transaction ID for each request, which is specific to that request, which allows us to do statistics, set performance goals, and so on? How do we then process that request? Do we process it within the web service owning region, or do we use some kind of dynamic routing to the application owning region, which is generally considered to be the best practice? And in general, how do we ensure that the service is always available? So if we could go to chart 9, please, Joseph. And again, on this chart, I've tried to summarize some of the best practice, bearing in mind that there's much more information available in another red book, which is the Kix Web Services Workload Management and Availability red book. So we can use mainframe workload management capabilities such as Sysplex Distributor, TCP/IP port sharing, MQ sharing to distribute our web services across a set of Kix regions. That's the first thing to do in order to ensure availability. We can then use some kind of dynamic routing to route those requests from the receiving regions to a set of application-only regions, and typically these are the application-only regions that are hosting the business logic programs, the existing applications. Why do we want to make this split? Probably for the same reason that you have probably split your TOR, your terminal only regions, from your application only regions. A separation of concerns, the ability to host applications in one region and process web services in another. It makes some sense. Another reason is that it may take you some time to migrate your application only regions. But your web service only regions do not have to be the same version of KIX as your application only regions. So it means that you can get the benefits of the latest version of KIX for your web services without having to wait for the migration of your KIX application only regions. The other point on this chart is that we have to have some way of monitoring our services to know that they are performing and to their response time goals. And again, in the project example, I'm going to show you some ways of doing that. If we could move forward to chart 10, please, Joseph. And here we consider the third major consideration from a deployment perspective for web services. And probably it's the one that most customers are the most concerned about. And that is, how will my web service perform? What response time can I expect? How many processors do I need? And how can I optimize that? Again, in the project example, I'm going to show you some real benchmark performance results with CPU consumption and response time. This chart, the point of this chart is basically to say that you need a way of doing some performance testing before you go into production with any type of web services solution, let alone a KIX web services solution. So you need a way of simulating workload, as shown on the left of the chart. You need a way of measuring the CPU cost. And you need to be able to check that the solution provides a linear scalability. As you increase the workload, the CPU consumption per service remains relatively constant. We can go to the next chart, Joseph, chart 11. And again, for the third time here, a summary chart that summarizes performance best practice. The details are in another red book called Considerations for KIX Web Services Performance. The first thing that determines the cost of a web service is the length of the SOAP message, the request message, and the response message. So there are simple things that we can do, and that is we can make sure that we don't send redundant data. We can make sure that the tag names of the elements within the SOAP body are not excessively long. So we can do something in the development process to reduce the size of the message. Paul explained some of these techniques in last week's webcast. The CPU consumption is also significantly impacted by the complexity of the message. So we have the length of the message and the complexity. The complexity is whether it's a flat XML structure or whether it's a very deep hierarchical structure with lots of child elements. So again, in the design phase, we can influence the complexity of the SOAP message that will be used. If you have a very complex form area structure and you create a web service from it using one of the utilities, you will probably get complex SOAP messages. And if that's the case, there is an alternative to just web service enabling that program, but it's to write a wrapper program that sits between the service requester and the target business logic program that has a simpler interface and therefore simpler SOAP message. And it then calls the existing business logic program with its more complex COM area structure. And again, Paul explained how we provide tools to do this, particularly the rational developer for System Z. So we have the length of the message, the complexity of the message, and we have the third key point here is the security that you apply to the web service. And this is real data in the bottom right-hand corner of this chart. It's the cost in CPU milliseconds or CP milliseconds of a web service. The first bar is with no security. And the last bar is with web services security, encryption, and XML digital signature. And then you have a couple of bars in between. I'm not going to go through that test in detail. It's just there to highlight that security can cost a significant amount. It can cost 50% more, 100% more, and in this case, it can even cost 1,000% more. So it's a key factor when determining the best solution from a security perspective and also from a performance perspective. If we could go to chart 12, please, Joseph. So let me then go on to my project example because I went through those best practice considerations quite quickly. Let's see here now in a real case for a real customer how, if you like, we put that best practice into practice. So the chart shows some customer background information from which you get an impression of the size of the customer. It's a bank. I would say it's more than a bank. It's a financial group of banks, insurance companies, and so on. It's a significantly sized multinational financial institution that have been implementing web services now for at least 3 or 4 years, are in production with web services, and now I'm going to summarize in 20 minutes or so our project. If you want more detail on this project, you simply go to the link which is shown on this chart, and you can download the white paper that we wrote, which is a 20-25 page paper on the project. Our project scope was to determine the best infrastructure, bearing in mind the security, workload management, and scalability requirements for this particular customer, and to understand how they could manage and monitor the infrastructure. So let's go to chart 13, please, Joseph. So whenever we do a proof of concept or proof of technology like this, we have a set of usage scenarios that we test. We're not implementing in Montpellier. In Montpellier, we have our own data center where we implement proof of technologies and benchmarks. We don't implement a complete solution for a customer. We test scenarios which represent the usage scenarios that customer expects to see when he implements his solution in production. So this customer wanted to use and is currently using Kix Web Services as a service provider and also as a service requester. As a service provider, which is the top of the chart, we see that those services are called from WebSphere applications running on different platforms. This is the internal integration, if you like. But those services are also called from outside, from business partners. And in this case, we wanted to put in an extra layer of security, a way of protecting our service. And we used the WebSphere Data Power SOA appliance. WebSphere Data Power is a box, as is shown on this chart. It's a physical box. And it acts as the web service endpoint, and it performs certain functions. You can do different things, not just security, but you can, if you like, you can parse the whole message and pass that message in a non-web service format to your mainframe system. Or you can do things like auditing and protecting against different types of potential attacks. So we have the data power, that's the indirect call from a business partner. Similarly, for a service requester, Kix can make a service request directly to a WebSphere application server or indirectly through a WebSphere data power appliance. If we go to the next chart, Joseph, which is chart 14, which shows our tested configuration. As I said, in Montpellier we have test systems. We test, we make proof of technologies for customers. In this case, we decided to use as our WebSphere host, which is hosting web services, but also making web service requests to Kix, as a WebSphere running on ZOS. But it could be, and it is in the customer environment, on any platform. And here we see, again, data power being used as a gateway. We might want to refer to it as a service bus that takes requests from service requesters and forwards these on to Kix or, in this case, WebSphere. And here I highlight some of the things that data power is used for in this proof of concept. It's a common access point. We use it to map identity because the identity of a business partner, for example, is unlikely to be a RACF user ID. So we may have to map that identity to a RACF user ID. Data power to do this can access LDAP. It can access other Tivoli-based solutions that can do these mappings. We use it for auditing, and we use it to assert identity based on what I said previously to pass on an already authenticated identity. If we go to chart 15, please, Joseph. So that was a discussion around security. What about the availability capabilities? We implemented, basically, as I showed you in a general form previously, something ahead of our existing application-only regions. So on the right-hand side of this chart, you see two sets of application-owning regions. They're called XYZ set and ABC set. Why two? Because the financial group owns several banks and other financial companies and hosts these on their mainframe in and hosts these applications in separate Kix regions. So when we considered how to expose these as web services, we could have exposed these web services directly on these application-only regions. But we would have had to have done so on every one of them, and there are hundreds. So instead, we decided to implement the web service-owning region idea, which is to front-end our application-owning regions with what the customer calls an inbound gateway owning region. It is running the web service processing. It runs an adapter which converts the incoming XML message into a COM area and links to the existing application-owning regions. It does this for each of the different banks or brands. And so it has to know for an incoming request, is this a request for brand ABC or brand XYZ? There are different ways in which you could do this. We use the TCPIP name as an indicator of the brand that the request is for. So the IGOR in this case is setting the context. It's also where we define what transaction ID will be used and what user ID will be used for the running of this web service request. If we go to chart 16, please, Joseph, we see exactly the same configuration, but in this case, it's where existing Kix applications have to make outbound web service requests Again, we could have implemented that API in the application-owning regions, but we decided to separate this into, and you may laugh at this point, but a separate Kix region which we refer to as an OGOR, or an outbound gateway-owning region. And so we have a separation of application logic from web service logic. We can go to the next chart, Joseph, which is chart 17. Now, the next series of charts really show the definitions that we made during this project in order to enable our proof of technology. I'll go through them quite quickly because I don't have too much time. At a high level, we see here the Kix Web Services framework. And we see the resources that have to be defined in order to process a web service. So this web service is invoked with a URL, which is HTTPS, because we use SSL to secure the connection. Then the TCPIP name, which, as I said previously, specifies for us the bank name. A port, which is a shared port, because multiple Kix regions are listening on that port. And then we have the URI, which is the application and the operation, if you like, on the application. This is an account transfer. We have four resource definitions. We have the TCPIP service. The TCPIP service is what specifies the transport settings. So it defines the port, and it defines other things that we'll see on a subsequent chart. The URI map is what maps the incoming URI and determines what web service is invoked and can also be used to set context like transaction ID. We have the pipeline, which is configured using a pipeline configuration file, and it is what determines what message handlers are called. We have a message handler, which is used to pick out a security credential which is coming in the SOAP message. We also have a message handler which audits the request. And so these are the key resource definitions that you need to define in order to process a web service request. We go to the next chart, Joseph, chart 18. Before we go to those resource definitions, I just wanted to show you, because this will be relevant for the performance data that I show you, what is a typical incoming SOAP message and a typical outgoing SOAP response message. For our test, and this is one of several tests that we did, incoming, what we see here is a SOAP envelope. At the bottom, we see a SOAP body, which has two elements, a count and a delay. Basically, what we were testing here was, in this particular test, a web service which retrieves information. I'll show you the information on a subsequent chart, and the count is the number of records that the service requester wants to retrieve. The delay is something that we add into the web service, into the WSDL, which tells the target program how long to delay for, because we don't want to test a ping-like service which responds immediately. What we also see in this SOAP envelope is a header, and that contains a security header, and in that security header we have a username token, which is one of the token types supported by Kix, and in there we just have a username. Now, how that username got there, I don't have time to explain on this call, but basically that was the role of an intermediary system that was doing authentication for us and us mapping and doing an assertion of an identity. So we can trust that that user has already been authenticated. If we go to chart 19, please, Joseph, we see the corresponding SOAP message response. The SOAP message response is basically, in this particular test, and we did many tests, in this particular request, it is a list of customer records. Now, a customer record for a bank includes the username, the name, the customer name, the address, an account balance, and information. And this is a typical use of KIX for web services. Get me information on a list of customers, or get me information on the accounts owned by a particular customer. This response is the top of, because it doesn't show the whole response, a response containing 10 customer records. This will be relevant when we look at the performance data. If we can go to the next chart, Joseph, which is 20. So, a quick run through those different resource definitions. And I won't take too long because all of this is explained in detail in the white paper. The TCP/IP service, here we define the port number, which is a shared port. Socket close is an interesting attribute. It determines whether we keep the socket open between KIX and the service requester. This is an important attribute because if we're doing SSL, we do not want to open and close sockets for every request. So we can optimize that by keeping the socket open, and we keep the socket open in this test for 30 seconds if the requester doesn't send another message within 30 seconds, we'll close the socket. The security attributes is where we specify how the subsystem that's calling us has to authenticate, and we use client authentication, and we use the certificate provided by the client to authenticate. This is how we are establishing trust between the subsystem that's calling us. This is not the identity of the end user. The identity of the end user is passed in the SOAP message itself. These are SSL requirements to ensure that the system that's sending the request to us is a trusted server, has a client certificate that we trust, has been signed by a CA that we trust. We go to the next chart, please, Joseph. Similarly, we see the URI map. The URI map is what maps the web service request. It contains a lot of functionality. We can filter web service requests. We can, in this case, for example, here we have a URI map for the account transfer service, and we are filtering on the host name. This is an option, but we found it useful. So this URI map only applies if the host name used on the service request, the URI, is abc.something.something. It means that we can have different URI maps for different, in our case, requests associated with different brands or banks. And that means that we can set transaction identifiers, and we set the transaction identifier here of TABC, transfer for brand ABC, based on a number of criteria, including the host name, including what TCP/IP service was used, and so on. So the URI map is a very powerful way of filtering web service requests and determining the context under which those web service requests will run. We could go to chart 22, Joseph. Here we have a pipeline configuration. In the pipeline configuration, we define which message handlers are to run. In this particular project, we wanted to run a message handler. That message handler is called SRSetUID. SetUID means we are going to set the user ID to be associated with our running web service. And we're going to do that based on the contents of a header in the message, in the SOAP header called the security header, which is what we saw on a previous chart, containing a RAC FID. So here I have a message handler which is specific to the which has a role to set the user ID associated to the task that's going to run the web service. We were doing this originally in the KixTS 3.1 environment because the customer was running on KixTS 3.1. If we go to the next chart, chart 23, please, Joseph. In KixTS 3.2, you have the option of doing the same, implementing the same security model, but in this way, without having to write your own message handler, simply to configure the Kix supplied web services security message handler. And we do this by configuring the pipeline using the WSSE handler configuration. So this is a configuration that I could use in KixTS 3.2 to do exactly the same thing as we did with a message handler user written. We could go to chart 24. The end result of all those configurations and resource definitions is that we will run our web service, and our web service will run with a transaction ID, which is, in our case, in this example, TABC. And in fact, we can apply security checks against two different identities. The second identity shown here, task 331, is the user ABC user 1. This is the user ID which came with the SOAP message. Task 330 is the user ID which has been mapped from the client certificate provided by the intermediate system. It's very powerful to be able to authorize particular users, end users, to particular services, and also to limit what services can be called depending on what route they come through, whether they come through one server or another server. And this is really quite similar to what we already do with MRO connections, because if you're familiar, we have link user ID and flowed user ID, and it's also quite similar to what we do with Kix Transaction Gateway type of connectivity to Kix. So if we go to chart 25, chart 25 shows the configuration that we tested. And again, this comes back to the availability requirements. This customer has high availability requirements, and so we wanted to use the capabilities of Sysplex, the capabilities of parallel Sysplex, such as Sysplex Distributor, which is used to route requests to one TCP/IP stack or another, Dynamic Transaction Routing, which is used to route requests from the EGORs to the application-owning regions, and then traditional things such as DB2 data sharing for the business logic programs. And interestingly, for the audit log that we write from within a message handler, we also wrote that into a user journal which is shared in the coupling facility, so we have one copy of the audit log. What the customer asked us to do was to then perform various availability tests, which meant cancelling various components, be it a Kix, or in this example, we cancelled the TCP/IP stack running on LPAR 1. And if we look at the next chart, which is chart 26, we see the results of that test, where basically we are running at, you can barely see it, but it's 50 services per second. And then we cancel the TCP/IP stack, which is the TCP/IP stack owning the Viper address. Viper is part of the Sysplex distributor capabilities. And we see a drop in the service rate, but it quickly comes back up to the 50 services per second. So this gives us confidence that even if we lose a half of our Sysplex, our service is still available. If we go to the next chart, chart 27, please, Joseph. Right. The third deployment consideration for the customer, we've covered security, we've covered availability. What about scalability and performance? So I now include just a few charts on the results of our benchmark. And basically, we were asked to measure the cost of that web service that I showed you previously. A simple request message, which is a request to retrieve a number of records, and a longer response message, which is the list of customer records. And here we see the results in terms of response time for three different workloads with 400 users, 600 users, 500 users, sorry, and 600 users. What we see here is the response time of Kix, which is the yellow bar, and the response time of WebSphere, which is the blue bar. The WebSphere response time includes the Kix response time. The Kix response time includes 50 milliseconds coded into the business logic program of delay using an assembler routine. And so basically what we see here is the actual response time of the web services infrastructure in Kix to be only 2 or 3 milliseconds. What we see on the right-hand side is that the requests per second increase linearly as the workload increases. So these are the types of tests that one has to perform if we're putting a significant application with a significant throughput into production. If we go to chart 28, please, Joseph. One of the things from a performance perspective that we were interested in finding out was what is the relative cost in terms of CP milliseconds for different lengths of message. And so what we see here is four tests. The first test is the SOAP request and response messages that I showed you previously with 10 records. 10 records in this particular test is about 3.3K in length. And then an increasing number of records in the response message. So here Kix is a service provider, and it's having to generate longer and longer response messages. And clearly that is going to impact on the CP cost with inside Kix. Basically what we found here was that we could increase the message length by 20-fold with a 3-fold increase in CPU. And in this case, as I say, Kix is a service provider. If we look at chart 29, we see the same test. In this case, Kix is a service requester, and Kix is having to parse the longer response message coming back to Kix. Because we could deploy these web services in multiple ways, Kix as a requester, Kix as a provider. Here we see slightly higher CP costs because Kix is having to parse the response, and the response gets up to, in this case, 100K of XML. But it's very linear in that we're able to increase the message length by 35 at 6-fold increase in CPU. We didn't do exactly the same test as we tested with different lengths of message in this case, because we did this at a later time after the customer had gone into production with Kix as a service provider. So if we could go to the next chart, please, Joseph, chart 30. So that really was our tests that we could meet the key requirements of the customer, which were security, availability, and performance. The fourth thing we were asked to do was to demonstrate, and I've just got a few screenshots here really, to demonstrate best practice in terms of monitoring and managing web services inside Kix. And so I'll just go through these screenshots and give you a few pointers as to how we can use some of these tools that we have available in order to monitor a web services workload and ensure that our web services workload is meeting performance goals. The first chart here shows the Kix Flex SM web user interface. We use the web user interface of Kix Flex SM as the first view of where our web services are running, what KIX regions are processing our web services, how many times our web services are called, where our web services are running, because we're doing dynamic workload management, and how many tasks are running on each KIX region. So this is pretty much what you do today if you're not using web services for traditional 3270 or other ways of accessing KIX. And it's just to say that you can get that same information from KIX Plex SM. If we could go to chart 31, Joseph. Within our later tests, we also use the KIX Explorer, which has an interface to our KIX Plex and provides us with the same information. Again, which KIX regions are running the services, how many, and so on. Chart 32, please, Joseph. And most recently, in our last set of tests with KIX TS 4.1, we are starting to use the KIX Explorer not only to view data, but if you're familiar with the KIX Explorer, which is an Eclipse-based tool, you can also use it now to operate on resources. So, for example, you can take actions on web services to disable or enable web services. We go to the next chart, please, Joseph. In addition to the KIX-provided capabilities, we also implemented a set of Tivoli monitoring. And again, I will just go through a few screenshots, but basically, we deployed Tivoli or Megamon XE for KIX, and we also deployed ITCAM for SOA. And with these tools, we get a much richer view of our web services infrastructure because we can have agents running in different subsystems, in KIX, in Data Power, in WebSphere, so we can get a view of how a web service is performing across our infrastructure. We can go to the next chart, Joseph, chart 34. Here we see a screenshot from a Megamon XE for KIX, and it's giving us the same type of information as KIX Plex SM WUI, which is our services here. In fact, they are URI maps, and we see the number of times these URI maps have been used. That equates to the service counts. And the next chart, Joseph. And we can also, with a Megamon XE for KIX, is because we map our web service requests into specific transaction IDs, we can set performance goals for those transaction IDs, and then we can monitor and send alerts to the operator when a web service is no longer performing. So for example, this screenshot is showing that we set a performance goal of 1 second for a web service, which is certainly ample given the response times I showed you previously. And we then, if you like, doctored the service to provide us with a much longer response time, and then we showed how we can monitor and send alerts through emails or whatever to operators to say there's a problem with the service. Next chart, please, Joseph. ITCAM for SOA is where we can have an agent running in different subsystems. This is showing data from the Data Power agent. The Data Power is sitting in front of our web services, and it shows us information not only for web services, but for individual operations within the service. It can show us message lengths. It can show us response times. Message lengths are important because they determine the CPU cost of our service. If you have a service which is being exposed to your business partners, it's quite useful to know, you know, how much data they're sending and how much data you're having to send back, because that will determine quite directly the CPU costs of your application. So, if we could go to the next chart, Joseph. So I'm just going to finish now with two charts in which I will just point out some of the key differences that relate to our topics that we've discussed today, security, workload management, and performance, the differences between KIX TS 3.1 and KIX TS 3.2. Paul covered some of these in last week's presentation, so I'm not going to repeat anything he said, but I just want to pick out one or two things. The first thing I want to pick out is security. In the KIX TS 3.1 timeframe, we didn't really recommend the use of the KIX supplied security handler because it had a performance overhead. What we say today is, with KIX TS 3.2 and afterwards, use the KIX supplied security handler, especially if you're using simple username tokens like username and password or just username. And this you can do through configuration rather than having to write a program yourself. And it performs equally as well, if not better, than any program that you can write yourself. 3.2 is, as I mentioned previously, also where we introduce web services trust support. I haven't talked about that in this presentation because we didn't implement it in this particular project. We have implemented it for other customers, and this is where you can configure KIX to map security tokens by making calls using the WS trust specification to a product such as TFIM, Tivity Federated Identity Manager. A key thing between 3.2 and 3.1 is that there are general performance improvements through the optimization of HTTP processing, through code page conversion improvements, and the use of 64-bit containers. And we would recommend, therefore, that you migrate to 3.2 for those reasons. Having said that, many of these performance improvements have been retrofitted to 3.1. So if you're implementing KIX web services with 3.1, make sure you're on the latest maintenance levels and that you've got these web services performance enhancements. There's also the introduction of MTOM XOP support. I don't really have time to discuss that, but this is very relevant to you if you're passing large binary images or binary data, for example, scanned documents, in your web service request. This is not a common thing, but it is done, and that specification significantly improves the performance of such an application. If we can go to chart 38, Joseph. So here we compare KIX TS 4.1 to KIX TS 3.2. Paul talked about the WS addressing specification last week, so I'm not going to repeat that. There are general improvements in KIX TS 4.1 with the way that KIX Flex SM does dynamic workload management. It uses the coupling facility much more to contain the status, to hold the status of different KIX regions. So it's a more optimized workload management. It's a more even workload management, if you like. And because web services can reuse much of this dynamic workload management, distributed program link, and so on, a web services workload will also benefit from those KIX Flex SM improvements. And the other thing I would like to point out is performance. In the KIX TS 4.1 timeframe, the KIX web services runtime starts to use IBM ZOS XML System Services, XMLSS, as a parsing routine. And this means that some of the parsing cost can be offloaded to ZAP. Internal tests show around 10 to 15% because that parser is not used, for example, for the data mapping. It's used for part of the parsing of the SOAP envelope. But there is some benefit in offloading some of the CPU cost to ZAP processors. If we can go to the next chart, Joseph, which is the summary chart. To quickly summarize, because I run a little bit over time, hopefully this set of guidance, general guidance, and particularly the customer example, has demonstrated that KIX Web Services is ready and has been ready for some time for large-scale implementations of web services. And we have the capabilities within the web services support to secure services, to make them available, and to make them performant. We can go to chart 40, Joseph. This is a set of additional resources that you can refer to. I'm not going to go through them in detail, but there's a lot of information out there that will assist you in addition to these webcasts in any projects that you have. So I'm going to conclude there and hand back to Joseph.
At this point, Christian, we would like to open the line for questions.
Our first question comes from Nancy Vickery. Line is open.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I missed the last webcast, so I apologize if this was answered then. Is there a way to return an unlimited or unknown number of rows with an application as a CSS service provider? In your example, you were returning 10 rows or records, but similar to the way that DB2 can open a cursor on a result set, is there a way to do that?
Hello, Nancy. Because I think that's more of a development issue, so I'm going to ask Paul, who did last week's webcast, to answer that question for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, hello, Nancy.
Hi.
Yes, you can return variable numbers of fields as part of a response, and there's several ways you can do that. There's the most natural way to do it is actually if you're starting with a WSDL-based description of your service. Because WSDL, of course, includes something called an XML schema that describes the structure of the application data. But within that schema, you can specify the occurrence rules for particular pieces of information. You can say the minimum number of times that it will recur and the maximum number of times.
Yes.
And on that maximum occurrence, you can actually say unbounded.
Yes.
So you can actually say there is no theoretical limit to this.
Can I translate that into COBOL?
Okay, so what happens then is that, yeah, you pass that through our development tools, and that produces you as output a set of COBOL language structures, and that's what you end up writing your applications from. So if you've got an existing Kix application that implements most of what you already want, then that might be an opportunity to write what we call a wrapper program, which will map between the interface you're exposing to the outside world and the existing program that you have deployed in Kix. So that's one way. That's the way that's most natural from the point of view of a web service. But yeah, there's nothing to stop you from implementing a pagination service of some kind that will call into Kix and retrieve a particular number of records and return, and your caller would then be responsible for making the necessary number of requests in. We don't have any special enablement for that within Kix, but there's nothing to stop you from doing that kind of thing. You could then maintain your cursor as a field within either the application data or possibly as a header on the slope message. There are mechanisms you can use for doing that kind of thing. But if that's something you want to pursue, then now we can discuss that offline, maybe.
Okay, sure. That sounds good. Thank you very much, Paul.
Janet Forlinson, your line is open.
Hi. My question is kind of the flip side of what Nancy was asking. We're about to write a service provider that's going to get a variable number of customer records in the XML coming into us. And we have chosen to implement our pipeline using channels and containers that it passes on to our program. We've run our WSDL through a RDZ generator to get COBOL copybooks, what you call language structures. We've tried to look in your documentation and we've tried to look at the copybooks. We're not understanding how we're going to get multiple customers back. Do we do multiple execute CICS get on the same container name, or are we going to do one execute CICS get and then get a variable length string of customer information rows?
Well, I think it's another development question, so I'm going to sloping shoulder to Paul again.
Okay, no problem, Nigel. Yeah, okay, so when you process that style of Wurzel through CORDZ, the language structures that are built for you, they involve a certain amount of indirection through the use of Qix containers. And so, yeah, the technique that you have to use is to build up within your working storage or a list of records, and then to write that list of records into the container.
No. We're the provider. We're getting this on the request. We're getting a variable length of record.
Okay. So the equivalent. You still read this entire container which holds a set of records, but then there's a mechanism you can use to iterate across the individual records. We actually have a section in the information center that describes this. We also have a red book, the full title is. It's a red book on developing Qix applications as web services. Contains an example of doing this sort of thing as well.
Eileen Barco, your line is open.
Yes, okay, I just have a few questions. Probably don't be one given. I'm going to have a problem. Where are the SOAP calls response codes documented? I can't find any numbers. Looking all over the place, I can't find what a response 1 equal 2 and a response 2 equals 6A is. I don't see any numbers anyplace.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question, though.
So where are the SOAP calls response codes documented? Like, I'm getting the reason of the SOAP call built, and I'm getting a response 1, 2, and response 2, 6A, and I don't find any place where they document these numbers.
Okay, so SOAP fault codes are something that vary depending on what process has caused them to be created. So there are some SOAP fault messages which are associated with standard specifications, such as, for example, the WS security specification that Nigel's been talking about. And in that kind of example, response codes are actually documented in those external specifications themselves. But there's also SOAP fault messages that are issued by Qix itself, if something goes wrong within the Qix infrastructure. And there's also the opportunity for applications themselves to return application-specific SOAP fault messages. So the precise nature really does depend on what process triggered the fault message to be produced. Now, I'm not familiar with the specific SOAP fault codes that you listed there, but if those are standard codes issued by Qix, then I would expect that there is a list somewhere. Unfortunately, I don't know exactly where that is.
Okay, no,
there might be another one for me to get back to you, Chris.
Thank you. I just wanted to question. If you do a pipeline scan and you don't hard code a web service, how does it know where the WSDL is? There's no pointer to it anyplace else that I can see.
Okay, so this is for a question regarding installing WS bind files as part of a pipeline scan. It's something we talked a little bit about last week.
Yeah,
something you can also do though, at the same time that you put your bind files into the web services directory associated with the pipeline, you can actually store a copy of the WSDL file in there at the same time. And if you do that, as Qix installs web service resources, it will also set up the references on the web service resource to the WSDL. But that's something that's optional. You don't have to do that. But if you do choose to do that, then the web service resource in Qix, if you inquire on it or if you view it, that will show you the associated WSDL document. And that in turn is something that you would have to do if you wanted to use the validation feature within Qix that we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is to put the WSDL into the pickup directory at the same time as the WS bind file. And that's something that if you use Rational Developer for System Z to do the deployment, it's something that I believe RDZ does for you automatically.
Yeah, I'd like to just make a comment because I didn't make it clear as I was going through the project example. And as is pointed out there, those resources that are required for a web service, yes, you need to hard code the TCP/IP service, and you need a pipeline definition. But the web service and the URI map definitions can be installed dynamically as part of the pipeline scan process. Now, there are different schools of thought, and different customers seem to have a preference one way or another. The particular customer that this project example is based on prefers to define those resources themselves using their normal resource definition process rather than having them dynamically installed, because they use them for lots of different things. I mentioned there in terms of all the different attributes that you can define on a URI map, including things like host name, TCP IP service. Not all of these can be used if the pipeline scan process is used, I believe, or may correct me. And also, but they do use the pipeline scan process for developers, but they choose to hard code these in RDO groups for their production systems to have a better control of what's in them.
I show no further questions at this time.
Thank you, Christian. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.